Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we're going to hear about new developments in the field of children's mental health, which is much on the minds of many of us in light of so many shocking tragedies reported in the media recently. And related to that, we'll be hearing, too, about social and emotional learning programs in elementary and middle schools. But first, there's a new development relevant to my ongoing campaign on this program to democratize the Social Security tax. We really need to focus some serious activism on this now because the people in Congress are wheeling and dealing on budget issues again for the next several weeks, which is always worrisome. You may have heard that Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois recently said a few weeks, days ago to the Republicans that it would be fine with him if long-term cuts were made to Social Security benefits. Because, he asserted, quote, Social Security is going to run out of money in 20 years. The baby boom generation is going to blow away our future. We don't want to see that happen, unquote. That's been critiqued in the alternative media, but not the mainstream media. And the truth is, of course, that Social Security will not run out of money in 20 years. The program currently has a surplus of more than $2 trillion. In fact, other programs borrow from it. But it's also true that Social Security will be unable to pay all benefits at current levels far into the future unless the system is tweaked. And to do that, instead of penalizing the elderly who have worked all their lives and are now living on their earned benefits by cutting their monthly checks, and instead of burdening the generations now working by increasing the amount of the tax on their earnings, the only fair and just change we should make to the Social Security program is to democratize the way it gets its revenue, which, by the way, has nothing to do with the federal debt because Social Security has its own source of revenue. The way the law stands now, I'm sure you know, everyone in America making up to $113,700 annually pays a Social Security tax of 7.65% of their annual earnings into the program, Social Security program, and then your employer pays the other half, an equal amount on your behalf. But all those people in this country, and it's a hell of a lot, who make more than $113,700, pay absolutely no Social Security tax on the whole portion of their earnings above that cap. So that's a lot of attorneys making a few million a year, middle management people, doctors, certainly sports stars, celebrities. We're all paying on all our earned income. They're paying on only a fraction of theirs. Why is that? So we have a flat tax for Social Security in this country, and it should be applied equally on all of everyone's earnings. Simple. Therefore, the cap on taxable income for the Social Security tax needs to be abolished. Okay, I've been saying that for a year. Lots of other people, not too close to the mainstream, alas. But here's the new development. There is now actually a bill in Congress that will abolish the cap on taxable income for the Social Security tax and do even more. It's called the Strengthening Social Security Act, and it's been introduced jointly in the House of Representatives by Representative Linda Sanchez, Democrat from Southern California, and in the Senate by Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa. This act would gradually phase out the cap on taxable income for Social Security entirely. So the whole program would be in clover into eternity. And it would correct two other problems as well. Number one, it would increase Social Security benefits by an average of approximately $70 a month by modifying the formula used to calculate the benefits. And number two, it would increase the Social Security cost of living adjustments, which are called COLAs, by using a COLA formula that is more accurately reflects the actual living expenses of Social Security beneficiaries, unlike the appalling chained CPI benefit cuts, which President Obama said he'd go along with. Needless to say, Pelosi and the rest of the Democratic leadership are not pushing this bill because the party, the party's thoroughly in need of big campaign donations, just like the Republicans are. So people who are making over that $113,000 a year are the sweet spot for the big campaign contributions. So they're very afraid of affronting them, which is what's been blocking this obvious democratizing of Social Security till now. So please see what you can do to draw attention to this bill. I can't even believe it's been proposed. It's so rational, and it's in Washington. Again, it's called the Strengthening Social Security Act in the House. It's House Bill 3118. In the Senate, it's Senate Bill 567. Let's get on it. Now, for our topic today, I'm sure we've all seen the articles in the media about children in middle school, and the one boy in Greenwich was 15, just starting high school. A girl was in middle school in Florida, committing suicide because of intense bullying by classmates. And then just the last few days, middle school-age boys going to their school with a gun, a semi-automatic handgun in Nevada, for instance, and killing people. So there was a program about this, which I didn't see, but I heard about it on the Today Show, and they brought together young girls who'd been bullied. They wanted to know, well, what's going on in the schools now? How is this working? What's the story? And they asked the girls, what motivates the people who are bullying? Because in the past, and I've mentioned this before, the sociologists and psychologists always assumed that children who bully in school are just replicating patterns they've witnessed in the home. But the more recent stories say, no, no, no. They act out this mode of behavior to elevate themselves in the social system and maintain their position in this hierarchy. So you have to be looking down on people, putting them down, and even acting out verbally in such ways that do that and demonstrate that you're on top of this situation. So that's very different from what had been thought in the past. So anyway, they asked these girls on the Today Show, and the one said, I feel like most mean girls, they do it for power. Some girls do it to remain part of a clique or a clique. Even if they're not usually cruel, they say mean things to fit in. This one said, I feel like some people are just sucked in, like my friend. She's been my friend for years, and recently in middle school, she's popular because of some of her mean friends. She's not a mean person, but when she's with them, she's mean to other people, and she feels like she has to be mean. And parents, these girls said, just look the other way. So these incidents, and of course, the even more serious shootings, the bullings, the shootings, and certainly the suicides, are part of a much larger phenomenon we're going to hear about now. And my guest today is Barbara Shaw. During her tenure as director of the Illinois Violence Prevention Authority, a position she held for 15 years until her retirement in September of 2012, Barbara Shaw led statewide efforts to build and implement a comprehensive plan. She also led these statewide efforts to address mental health needs of children and youth. In 2001, she chaired a task force on children's mental health that brought together a diverse group of early childhood advocates, mental health professionals, parents, and educators, and many other groups who produced a report for the state government called Children's Mental Health, subtitle, An Urgent Priority for Illinois. I'm mentioning this here as a model for other states. What she has managed to do here with the government of Illinois, bringing so many active components of this situation together, is extremely interesting. So they produced this report. The report then served as a basis for the enactment of the nationally recognized Illinois Children's Mental Health Act. This was in 2003 or 4. This act created the Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership. This is an ongoing nonprofit. And Barbara was appointed chair by the governor. She continues to serve in that role today, and she has led the Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership through development and implementation of a comprehensive strategic planning process that places an emphasis on mental health promotion, prevention, and early intervention. She was also co-founder and serves as a member of the executive committee of the Illinois Childhood Trauma Coalition. Barbara Shaw, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Charlene. It's terrific to be here. I thoroughly enjoyed your information about Social Security, and
oh,
I will personally act on that myself.
The wall,
that
how
was,
no one ever mentions abolishing the caps. You know, they have these so-called bipartisan little groups and committees, and one of them with all these Wall Street players, and they say, well, we'll have to, even the Democrats, we need a little bit of this. We'll cut people's benefits a little bit. We'll raise the taxes on working people a little bit.
And here is, as you said, a very
rational
answer.
None of that is necessary. None of that is necessary.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Anyway, I do want to bring to people's attention, speaking of that, the fact that wearing your other hat, I asked you to come on the program the day before International Women's Day, that was March 7th last spring, and tell us about current efforts in preventing violence against women. So any listeners who are involved with that issue, and why not, check out Barbara Shaw on the archival tape of this program for March 7th of this year, which is available free at the website prn.fm. So today I've asked you to come wearing your other hat, that of a very savvy activist and administrator who's successfully building a model for state-level responses to many issues in children's mental health. And I wonder, after all these years of involvement, what your thoughts were recently when you read about the teenage suicides resulting from bullying or even the murders committed by these boys in middle school. I ask that because it seems that these very young aggressors were in an extremely agitated mental condition, which they couldn't get out of.
Absolutely. And, of course, it touched a range of thoughts for me, or elicited a number of them. One is, just as you said, I mean, these children are obviously going through some form of internal strife and stress. And in some cases, it's some aspects of it is apparent, and people comment retrospectively about that.
Uh-huh.
And in others, you hear comments like, this was a quiet, nice kid, does well,
right.
You know, nobody would have ever thought kind of thing.
Right.
And what that suggests at a time when there's so much focus on children's mental health and social and emotional development, these kinds of incidents remind us that there is no quick fix, that we are, as a culture, suffering from our lack of attention to children's social and emotional well-being and mental health, that we are promoting values and behaviors by glorifying violence, by having TV shows that bring out and demonstrate in, whether it's in comedic fashion or in, you know, drama fashion, meanness and power and control as ways
mm-hmm.
of getting what you want, or
right.
even making sure that something bad doesn't happen. There's always that reach for aggression and meanness, and smash it up and blow it up. The presence in the everyday world of a child, of images, whether it's on their smartphone, in and around them, in their school, on TV, in the movies, in video games, the constant exposure to aggression and acting out one's anger and fear, and sometimes in extreme ways, that kind of constant exposure coupled with a real fragile self, and then add, you know, in the perfect storm there, an incident, a problem, an interaction
right.
with a young person who doesn't know how to manage their emotions, and boom.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting you mention the fragile self, because I've talked before about how, oh, university campuses have had to put psychotherapists, counselors, in all the dormitories. And they have a much higher incidence of suicides and people needing hospitalization. And as one of the psychologists who was involved in that work on a state university said, it's as if they don't have the same kind of emotional grounding as earlier generations. Something that would have been a rough patch for a college student in earlier generations just sends them into a collapse, a psychological collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we call them the teacup generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're so right. The media is giving these messages to them that meanness works, mean girls, movies, TV shows, and all that. And there are big absences in the way our children are coming of age today.
And
what
they're
exposed play in
to.
Nature, which is a very mm-hmm. grounding experience for the human organism.
Mm-hmm.
And they also don't have anymore what psychologists called a culture of childhood, where we used to run around by ourselves all day and play with all the kids in the neighborhood. And in the course of that, you know, you make up games, you make up the rules, you figure out how to what to do if someone breaks the rule, should you change the rule or do something. But minus that, they go into the school system, and they don't have any experience of, like, negotiating and interacting in a relational way with other children. I mean, if you were a real mean bully in the neighborhood, people just wouldn't have played with you.
Mm-hmm.
But in the school system, of course, they can't get away from you. And if that's going to be your mode, then you have this, of course, captive audience. So I think both of those are so important. There are big absences in the way our children are being raised, the kind of grounding that they need, plus these very detrimental messages from the media. So,
mm-hmm.
go ahead. Then.
But I would add one other thing.
Uh-huh.
Grounding and then skills building. I mean,
yeah.
I think of children's social and emotional well-being and mental health as equal in importance as their physical health.
Uh-huh.
And their cognitive well-being.
Right.
And look what we as a society invest in developing and promoting that cognitive ability. Look what we invest in making sure our kids are physically healthy. Now, obviously, we can talk about some of our failures in all those regards, but
yes.
nonetheless, as a society, we still, as individuals and as a society, we invest a great deal in those two legs of the stool,
uh-huh.
but we do not invest at all the same amount of energy into promoting mentally healthy people.
Right.
With the skills necessary to understand their own emotions and to relay those and control those, you know, self-soothing, being able to calm down oneself when
right.
one is upset. That's
right.
a skill that
right.
some people don't have, that many people don't have. And so we have neglected to, in an organized and an intentional way, promote that mental health and social and emotional development and respond to problems early and treat in the most effective way. We're very, very behind as in our social development. At the same time, we're being inundated with, there's so much more intake into the psyche and into the self from you know, peers around us to the media to whatever
yeah.
That you know, the ability to manage what's coming in addition to a fragility of understanding of self and knowledge of how to communicate emotionally and socially, it all gets very, very bound up.
Yeah, right.
And so we are quite bound up.
Today I read in the materials from your organization that nationally over 20% of youth experience a diagnosable mental health problem at some time in their school years. And in terms of the kids who actually act out and end up in the juvenile justice system, up to 70%, some studies say, suffer from some form of mental illness. So I know some people would say, well, nothing to be done about that. It's genetic. But in fact, I was very interested, of course, in your studies that said if you reach these children early on, you can correct these problems. They're building certain mental patterns. As we know, the synaptic connections in our brain are like little freeways, and the more we habitually think certain kinds of thoughts, the more automatic those kinds of thoughts become. But we can build other pathways. So maybe you could talk about that early awareness.
Absolutely. You know, as I was listening to you describe your perspective on that, it reminds me that we don't give up on third graders or seventh graders who are failing in school and whose cognitive and learning abilities may just be suffering from not having the right kind of support, in contrast to a physiological, you know, inability to perceive information.
Right.
We don't give up. You know, we recognize that learning can happen and change can happen, and including pathways in the brain changing. However, it is also important to recognize that young children, particularly in those first years, the development of those pathways and changing those pathways can be very difficult. And a lot of misery and suffering can happen if those pathways aren't addressed early. There's so much research now going on, obviously, about the development of the brain and the impact of childhood trauma, the impact of social and emotional terror in the case of children exposed to domestic violence or children who are abused, that we're really learning that unless we get in there and address children at earlier ages and earlier stages of development of a problem, we're solidifying those pathways and making it harder and harder. Not that things can't change, but making it harder and harder and allowing for, as I said before, a lot of misery to go on in between.
Well, maybe you could say something. Actually, I was asking about intervention, but I want to back that up to the three here, prevention, intervention, treatment. What is the focus of prevention in very young children? Do you identify
the
situations in the home that might be problematic or what?
Well, a couple things. The emphasis on prevention is, number one, promotion. So that's where something like social and emotional learning skills or helping parents teach children how to self-regulate and self-soothe and identify their feelings and express their feelings. So it's a mental health promotion
set of
activities.
So it's putting out the model of what the healthy model is.
Absolutely. Teaching.
Yeah.
These are skills.
Right.
It's not just about how you feel. It's, first of all, knowing what you feel and then being able to act on it in some kind of way, either communicate it in an effective way or deal with it internally in an effective way. And those are skills.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly we learn them by what we see around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of style of perpetuating information has proven at this point not to be the best way to go.
Mm-hmm.
We really need to be much more thoughtful about how we make that happen. So first, prevention is promotion.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's promotion of mental health. Secondly, it's recognizing that there are children who, because of the circumstances that they're in, are at higher risk for mental health problems. And anticipating that, you give special attention to those kids and make sure that they get extra doses of the kind of promotion that is important here. It also means a great deal of public education and awareness. You know this, that mental illness, well, first of all, most people, when you say the word mental health, they automatically go in their head to mental illness. In contrast to when you talk about physical health, people think about health, what it means to be healthy. They don't automatically go to what it means to be ill and sick. Mental health, it's all about our emotional, social emotional reaction and stigma to mental illness. We fear it. We don't understand that mental health problems fall along a continuum, just like health problems do. You know, we have sneezes in our mental health. We have flus in our mental health. We have chronic diseases in our mental health, in our mental health, like we do in our physical health. And we need to accept that as part of our being and reduce the stigma. So that's a very important thing to be creating public awareness about, so that people can talk about it. Say It Out Loud was our public awareness campaign phrase, the name of our campaign, being able to talk about how one feels and what is going on. So a great deal of public education and awareness. Helping parents is a biggie, whether it's through home visits or support groups or what have you. Providing opportunities for parents to deal with the very difficult challenges that parenting in today's society involves, and particularly parents who may not have learned some of these skills and abilities themselves. I mean, we're all, and that includes childhood, not just parents, well, not just parents who are parents only, but parents who are early childhood providers and mental health providers and school teachers. All of us are also walking around with aspects of our mental well-being that may have not been developed very well, or maybe the depth of which the problems may even be unknown to us. You know, we don't realize sometimes where we're vulnerable. So there's so much work to be done to help parents who are working with young kids and adolescents to understand mental health and social and emotional well-being, and teach their kids in ways and help their kids develop strength in those areas. It's a very important thing. When we did our social and emotional learning standards work in schools, and I know we'll talk about that more a little bit later, but we had a parent component to that. We wrote up the information about social and emotional learning skills that were being taught in school and sent it home to parents as a way of saying, this is, you know, this is what's going on in your schools. Reinforcing it at home is good. We had parent advocates who were part of the team of people who worked with a school district or a school to develop an understanding of the social and emotional learning standards. So we had parents involved in that. Very critical that the family world is affected by awareness and skill building kinds of activities. So that's some of what prevention looks like.
I just want to say, listening to all of this, since I wrote that book, Relational Reality, and there's a whole chapter on this, what I call the relational shift. I look at it in different areas of society. You certainly see it in healthcare, the study showing that the number of friends an elderly person has affects very strongly how well and how long they keep their motor coordination. I mean, things that no one would have guessed 10 years ago. And we're seeing in the educational area, what are the relational conditions necessary for learning? So
all connected.
I think this is extremely interesting, and it's part of a much bigger picture, which we'll come back to, but we have to pause now for the break. And I'll just tell you, this is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Barbara Shaw, about addressing children's mental health issues. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Barbara Shaw, about new developments in children's mental health care. In case you're interested in getting something like this established in your state, here's the website for the Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership. It's I, as in Illinois, ICMHP.org. ICMHP.org for Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership. So, I want to move into the second half of this discussion, and you may have seen, if you read the New York Times on Sunday, they had a big spread in their magazine on September 11th called Reading, Writing, and Emotional Intelligence. If you want to find this on the internet, it was by the journalist Jennifer Kahn, K-A-H-N, Reading, Writing, and Emotional Intelligence. And they were addressing these many different approaches, different programs in the schools, but a very large number of them now across the country, in teaching social and emotional skills to children, being able to identify emotions, to calm themselves down, to name what's happening in their response to something, or name what's happening in someone else's emotional response. So in this article in the New York Times, it mentioned the state of Illinois, quote, the state of Illinois passed a bill in 2003 making, quote, social and emotional learning, unquote, a part of school curriculums. Well, there's a lot more to it than that, and we have the person here who was one of the key people in developing that. So can you tell us about the social and emotional learning standards that you sort of helped develop for the state of Illinois education system?
Sure. I do want to clarify one quick thing before heading into that, and that is that the Illinois Children's Mental Health Partnership is not a nonprofit. We have a nonprofit that sort of serves as our fiscal agent, but we're a governmentally, statutorily created body, like a commission, so to speak. So just wanted to make that little distinction for your listeners.
Got it.
Okay, social emotional learning standards. When we created the Children's Mental Health Act, we were looking at those, prevention, early intervention, and treatment goals and activities that we spelled out in our report. And in prevention, in the prevention circle, it talks about developing social and emotional skills as a universal need for all kids. And we had educators who were part of our group. We had early childhood folks who really helped us focus on what prevention really means in terms of very young children. And we recognized then at the early stage we had CASEL in our state, the Collaborative on Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, and many of us had worked with CASEL on this concept of social emotional learning. And so we decided that in our legislation we would require that our state develop social and emotional learning standards as part of the Illinois learning standards. And I want to say that the notion that it automatically made it part of the curriculums is not exactly right.
I thought that was an overstatement.
Because there are a variety of ways to teach those skills, and it's not always a curriculum. It can be a program. It can be a helping teachers learn how to create classroom environments where those skills come out and are naturally taught and utilized in natural situations. It can be about school policies and school themes that are promoted throughout the school about acceptable behavior and not acceptable behavior and those kinds of things. So it's not just curriculum. It's whole school climate. It's how people relate to one another in that environment as well. So we were worried. We didn't know exactly how the broader education community was going to react. We had an educator who ran the specialized services area for the Chicago Public Schools. And we had the large unit school district, which is an association of schools that were large, districts that were very large and had high numbers of students.
Mm-hmm.
And those folks were seeing every day in their schools the manifestation of what it means when children do not have social and emotional learning skills. And I want to divert just one little second to say it's not just a matter of kids not being taught skills. It's also a matter of kids suffering stresses from the world they live in. You know, when we were doing our education about family violence awareness, we would often play a 911 tape of a 9-year-old girl calling the police at 11 o'clock at night, begging them to come and stop her stepfather from beating her mother and her younger sister.
Yeah.
And it was a terrible call to hear, but always after we played that tape, I would say, imagine that child in your classroom tomorrow. How can that child learn when she's scared and anxious and may not have had any sleep? So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that kids bring into that classroom when they go in. So certainly the large units like Chicago were seeing this and were receptive. And we were worried, but you know what? We did fine. Very interesting, the fellow who is now our superintendent of schools, Chris Cook, a wonderful, wonderful educational leader, was at that time the head of special ed. And he was the person I was encouraged to contact and talk about what we were proposing. And the result of that is that the State Board of Ed essentially remained neutral, which is perfect in that situation. And what was interesting and really a good point, he was worried then about something we still haven't figured out. And that is, when you have learning standards, how do you assess whether you're achieving those standards? So do you do assessment at the individual level? Do we start measuring, you know, kids' behaviors and blah, blah, blah? Do we do it at a classroom level? How is it assessed? And it's a really good question. And it's one that the social and emotional learning movement is still sorting out. You know, we used to kind of do it informally. We had the other side of the report card, remember, deportment and things like that, how you behaved.
Plays well with others.
Which was some indicator back to parents about that stuff. But how do you really measure whether a child is developing the skills that social emotional learning is designed to teach?
So
it's a big question. You can see and measure the sort of classroom, how many incidents happened in the school? Was there a reduction in certain types of behavior? Or is there an increase in more positive behaviors? Do students on surveys and so forth indicate that they feel safe in their school, that they feel that it isn't a hostile environment? So you can gather general information. And we, you know, the looking at school climate and student report on things, but the whole issue of how you assess was his concern, but not enough to say don't do it. And so we did well. We passed the law. The standards were developed by a team of people that included educators and mental health people and children's advocates, people from the partnership, and the standards were developed and with the descriptors and subtitles and subtexts and all that type of thing, passed by the Illinois State Board of Education. And then, knowing that...
As guidelines or requirements?
It's a requirement.
Uh-huh.
However,
okay.
It's a requirement. These are learning standards for the state
uh-huh.
of Illinois.
Okay.
However, like many other standards and laws, they can be meaningless unless they're enforced, unless there's professional development so people know what they are and know how to do them. And in Illinois, for example, the only two learning standards that have any statewide measurement and enforcement about them are reading and math. So there are many other learning standards out there that are not assessed in terms of in any statewide way or even district-wide way, are not assessed other than in the grades the kids get, right?
Right.
And how well they do on tests. We knew that just like we knew with the Illinois Domestic Violence Act, that just because the law said police were supposed to do a certain thing, that didn't mean when they went to a scene, that didn't mean that it was going to happen. So we wrote the sheets that the police are supposed to hand out when they go into the house. So this
uh-huh.
team wrote the standards, and then we went back and asked for resources that were appropriated to the State Board of Ed to do professional development,
uh-huh.
to do parent involvement,
uh-huh.
and to do training of schools, and to do pilot projects in a number of school districts throughout the state, 3-year projects,
huh.
where they developed a plan for looking at what they already did. Many schools already had some form of character building or, you know, social and emotional development kind of programming going on.
Uh-huh.
And many schools had, some schools had even a pretty sophisticated development of all that. So assessing where you are, figuring out what it would need to, your school would need to comply with the learning standards, what are the projects and programs out there that can be used as tools, and then seeing how they did after a year or so of implementation. So,
uh-huh.
you know, and we're just beginning. I mean, we have 1,000 school districts in the state of Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And the work of really, this is a social movement. You know, it's like there was a day when schools didn't teach health, you know, and
right.
to get schools to the point where they can teach that and teach that well, or create environments that foster health.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
This is a long-term effort. But like you on the Social Security the policy that you're finally seeing manifested, we were thrilled when last year there was federal legislation introduced to create SEL on a
uh-huh.
nationwide basis
uh-huh.
and to promote, you know, school districts doing it. So we're in a very young movement here to
it's
change the school environment so that it recognizes the social and emotional and mental well-being of kids as deserving of energy and investment as the academic and the physical health.
Yeah, because, you know, so many studies have shown that it relates to whether they can learn well.
Absolutely.
And what kind of life they have.
Absolutely.
You know, they're seeing this, as they said, the early studies in the 1980s found out, oh my gosh, this is predictive.
Exactly.
That this ability to read emotions, as they said, this is John Mayer and Peter Salovey did this initial research on emotional intelligence and non-cognitive skills. They discovered, to their surprise, might actually be better predictors of a person's life trajectory than just
exactly.
standard academic measures. But when I listen to you about, you know, the guy, you take it to the guy who later becomes the head of the board, Illinois Education Department, and, you know, he says, well, how are we going to measure this? So that is the bane of all educators' existence now. Because
it is, and it's not his fault. I mean, it was an incisive kind of, oh, my God.
Barbara, I want to explain from inside education, as I was a professor for many years, and this whole econometric model was moved into education, and suddenly the administrators saying, you have to find ways to measure what they're learning, and we don't just mean the grades on their papers in graduate schools or the grades on their test in undergrad school. No, that doesn't tell us anything. You need to work out all these econometric ways of measuring what's being learned. And so when we're talking about something like, you know, relational intelligence, the relational conditions needed for a child to thrive and learn, and this has to be measured with econometric markers, it just seems like
a clash of cultures, for sure. It's a pressure that these school folks feel. You know, I want to, there was a wonderful comment to that New York Times story that you just talked about that I just want to lift a little from. This fellow says, as a therapist, he's from San Francisco, from California, as a therapist, I see patients all day long who were never taught this type of information.
Yeah.
As a result, as adults, they have difficulty finding words to express their feelings, cannot calm themselves down after being upset, cannot tolerate the intense feelings of others, may become numb or persistently depressed, and have obsessive negative thoughts long after the emotions have dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens when we don't learn as kids
right.
how to do these things.
Right. Well, it's interesting, too, in the New York Times article, the theme the journalist seemed to run through it was a lot of people saying, we shouldn't be going too fast. Some people want to put this in the core curriculum. We're not sure which programs work best and da-da-da. But she didn't double back and say, let's look at what's happened in Illinois, because I like your framework that we're going to do this. Now we'll have pilot programs and find our way. You know, we'll feel our way here. But we're going to address
to do it.
This. Yeah.
Yes, and it is a long challenge, and it's one that the state board is trying to integrate into its ongoing educational structure, which is also a challenge. But it's we feel very excited that we as a state were able to spring forward with these social emotional learning standards as a way of getting there. By the way, if your readers do look up this article, a number of the comments are very insightful and are worth looking at.
Yeah. It's a good, very good overview. Have other states followed suit with what you're doing in Illinois?
New York has been working on social emotional learning standards, but more as a, not as a learning standard that all schools had to live up to, but more as something that they would promote. And we've done a lot, and I know CASEL too has been all over the country in terms of working more closely with districts, so it hasn't really reached that state level yet.
CASEL?
But it was exciting see federal.
CASEL? Pardon? What's CASEL?
Oh, CASEL is the Collaborative on Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. They are based at the University of Illinois here in Chicago, and I mentioned them earlier that we had those folks in our state, so they also helped us. They're they're pioneers in school-based social and emotional learning. And we learned a lot from them and worked with them in doing the professional development with our schools throughout the state.
Well,
you know, it often boils down to some visionaries here and there, you know, who this social emotional learning, these particular studies that you talked about, and you know, few people really recognizing the power of this and moving forward with it in some way.
Yeah. I just want to tell the listeners that, speaking of emotional intelligence, that book that brought it to a lot of people's attention was, of course, the one by Daniel Goleman many years ago, and he will be the guest on this program on December 19th.
Oh, good.
So,
that's exciting.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have, but I want to thank you so much, Barbara Shaw, for being on the program.
My pleasure, Charlene. It's always wonderful to talk with you.
I like to learn a lot.
I mean, great conversations.
Okay. Well, let's amble over to the Arts Corner and see what we have today. And our poem today is by a youngish poet, Mary Zibist, and she was named about 2 weeks ago as being on the short list, one of five people nominated for the National Book Award in Poetry this year for her collection of poems entitled Incarnadine. And a few years ago, she was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry for her first collection, and that was entitled Granted. So the poem we'll hear today is from her new book, and it's entitled To You Again by Mary Zibist. Again this morning, my eyes woke up too close to your eyes. They're almost green orbs, too heavy-lidded to really look back. To wake up next to you is ordinary. I do not even need to look at you to see you, but I do look. So when you come to me in your opulent sadness, I see you do not want me to unbutton you, so I cannot do the one thing I can do. Now it's almost 1 a.m. I am still at my desk, and you are upstairs at your desk, a staircase away from me. Already it is years of you, a staircase away from me. To be near you and not near you is ordinary. You are ordinary. Still, how many afternoons have I spent peeling blue paint from our porch steps, peering above hedgerows, the few parked cars for the first glimpse of you? How many hours under the overgrown pink camellias, thinking the color was wrong for you, thinking you'd appear after my next blink? Soon you'll come down the stairs to tell me something, and I'll say, okay. Okay, I'll say it like that, say it just like that, and I'll go on being your never enough. It's not the best in you I long for. It's when you're noteless, numb at the end of my fingers. All is all. I say it is. And then for our song today, well, let's hear one by Katie Lang. Now there is a second alto. This recording was made during a concert performance during which, by the way, she sang the entire song while draped over the bass player. No kidding. It was charming. This is Katie Lang singing Fever. Here it is.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you wrap your arms around me, it gives me fever that's beyond compare. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Tell your sizzle, you know I'm gonna treat you right. You know I'm gonna treat you right. You know I'm gonna treat you.
That was Katie Lang singing Fever. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Rita Nakashima Brock, co-author of a new book, Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury After War. She's also the director of a program in Texas called Soul Repair. So if you know any veterans suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder, please invite them to listen to Rita Brock here on this program on November 7th. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.